It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an Appleton project is loaning people unique heirloom garden seeds. The founder of the Appleton Seed Library joins the show. First, a new report is raising questions about U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. According to Forbes, a confidential settlement was reached 2 weeks ago between Ross and a former business partner. That partner had accused Ross of stealing his interests in a private equity fund, transferring them to himself, then trying to cover it up. The settlement came right before the case was to go to trial with $4 million on the line. That may just be the tip of the iceberg, according to the Forbes report. It talked with 21 people who know Ross and say he engaged in fraudulent activity. Added together, the total could come to more than $120 million. Forbes estimates Ross to be worth some $700 million. In a statement, the Commerce Department has denied any wrongdoing and said that, quote, this rehash of old stories is clearly the result of a personal vendetta, end quote. Dan Alexander is the Forbes reporter behind the story. He covers Donald Trump, the people around him, and how they affect business. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, this was just part of the story we mentioned there. Can you give us the big picture, the various things that Wilbur Ross is accused of in allegations and in lawsuits?
Sure. Basically, they fall into two categories. One is that there is a remarkable number of people who used to work with Wilbur Ross who claim that after they left his firm, he stole their interests. And the second is that there are a lot of investors who worked with Wilbur Ross who say that he was skimming money from them as he was supposed to be investing their money, or that his firm was doing so. And this has led, as you said, to a lot of lawsuits, even an SEC fine that was levied just a couple of months before Donald Trump named Wilbur Ross to be the next Secretary of Commerce.
Talk about how that skimming works. Go into a little detail about the investors who were, in effect, being charged money they didn't think they were being charged.
Yeah, so there were a couple of different ways that it allegedly happened, and I want to emphasize that these are, you know, all allegations. We don't, most of them were settled, so we don't know exactly, you know, which of the allegations are right, but the patterns are remarkably similar across all of them. And generally, here's how it worked. So private equity firms, most of the money that they take in a lot of cases, are what's called management fees. And management fees are sort of the oxygen, if you would, for a private equity firm. This is, you know, 2% of all of the assets that they manage every year they get to take as a fee. Now, that adds up to a lot of money. You know, Wilbur Ross, his firm was managing like $4 billion. So, you know, 2% on that would be $80 million, 1.5% would be $60 million. You get the picture. So what they do is they say to the investors, okay, we're going to charge you a lot of money to hold these assets and manage them for you, but then we're going to give you basically a rebate on them. So if we're working on the deals, let's say that we invest in, I don't know, a shipping company, and then we serve on the board of that shipping company, then we're personally going to get fees for serving on that board. But that's not really fair for us just to get the money, because we're just doing our jobs looking after your investment. So what we'll do is we'll take the management fee amount and we'll give you a discount on that. And we'll say, okay, you know, now you pay the 1.5% minus however much we got in the board fees. And they weren't giving back as much of the board fees as they had promised. So some of the investors noticed this and caught wind of it, passed it up to the SEC, and ultimately that led to the fine. That was one of the alleged schemes. I can go into the other if that would be interesting to you as well.
Well, let's get into the other side of things. You mentioned the idea that former business associates say they had been, they're alleging that they were illegally locked out of their assets, or their assets were, I don't know how that works exactly. Ross and his company had taken them over. How did that part of things allegedly work?
So basically, the allegations are that after people left, you know, people who had served in the firm had gotten two types of interests. One were an investment that they might have put into a certain fund, and then that investment would either appreciate or depreciate depending on the performance of the fund. That's called a capital account. And then the second part was their carried interest. So if a private equity fund performs very well, then the people who are running that private equity fund get sort of an outsized share of the profits of it. And that part's called the carried interest. So the allegations here are that after those people left the firm, they still held those interests, they say. But what happened was their interests were then basically confiscated from them. So In the case of the capital accounts, those accounts were zeroed out, and then the money was redistributed to other people, primarily to Wilbur Ross, say the allegations. And in the case of the carried interest, similar thing would happen. The allegations are that Wilbur basically just stole it and said, you know, I'm going to take your carried interest now. So if these funds do particularly well, the share of the profits that you would have gotten are now going to go to me.
Talking to Dan Alexander from Forbes about his reporting on U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and multiple allegations of fraudulent activity. Here's a response from the Commerce Department. We read a bit of it earlier. Quoting here, the anonymously sourced Forbes story is based on false rumors, innuendo, and unverifiable claims. The fact remains that no regulator has made any of these accusations against the secretary. This rehash of old stories is clearly the result of a personal vendetta. The baseless claims made in this story were well publicized long ago and are not news. You on Twitter had taken some of those statements and challenged them. What was your response?
Well, I could take a long time going through that statement, but we'll just sort of start at the top with the, you know, attempt to discredit the story by saying that it's all based on anonymous sources. You know, there are four of Wilbur Ross's former employees who are actively pursuing litigation against the Commerce Secretary. It's hard to do anything less anonymously than file a lawsuit. You're putting your name next to an allegation in the public domain for posterity. And so if you have four people doing that all at once, and you have the SEC leveling a fine against the firm, and the SEC making the accusations that you misled and defrauded your investors, to say that all of that together somehow means that the story is based on anonymous sourcing goes to the very heart of the story, which is that a lot of these claims that they're making are not credible. And so you're trying to discredit a story by making a not very credible claim in itself. What was the second part that they said about it?
Regulator, they say, has made these accusations.
Yeah, so, you know, the SEC fined the firm and, you know, did make the accusations that the firm had defrauded and misled investors. It's true that in the settlement, the SEC does not name Wilbur Ross personally, but it was all against W.L. Ross. This is not a very large firm by private equity standards. And Wilbur Ross, according to the former employees, sort of led it by decree. He was, you know, the only guy running it from 2001 up until 2016, the whole time that those allegations were made and ultimately the settlement was agreed to. And those former employees say that these allegations were things that Wilbur would have definitely known about. Many of them say he orchestrated. So, again, I don't think it's a very fair way of putting it. I think it's a little misleading.
And this all comes as there's interest from members of Congress, including some Republicans, in Ross's disclosure or non-disclosure of his business interests, things he hadn't divested himself of even after he became Commerce Secretary. Give us a rundown on what's going on there.
Well, there's a lot going on there, but the basics of it are every time that a public official, particularly a high-ranking one, joins the government, they come to an agreement with the ethics office over which assets they're going to get rid of, and so that then they will not have conflicts of interest while they're serving. And Wilbur Ross, in November of 2017, filed a sworn document in which he swore that he had divested everything that he promised he would. At the time that he made that disclosure, that was not true. In fact, he owned at least $10 million of stock in the company called Invesco. This is a parent company of W.L. Ross, his old private equity fund. He also held an interest, which he had never disclosed, in a rail car manufacturer named Greenbrier. He also owned a stake in an air leasing company that he had said that he was going to divest, and he had a short interest in a bank called Sun Bank Corp, which he said that he thought that he owned a stake in, but did not own a stake in, and so he shorted it to try to balance out a stake that he believed he had. His explanation for all of that is that he made mistakes, that these were, you know, inadvertent errors. It's hard to get inside someone's head and to, you know what they knew at a certain time, but it seems difficult to believe that one of the most sophisticated investors in the country forgot about a $10 million stake in his former employer.
And briefly, what's the state of congressional interest and oversight of the Commerce Secretary?
There's a lot of it. So a brief rundown, there are two senators and one congressman who have asked the SEC to investigate an insider trading allegation, which is a separate thing that we can go into if you'd like. There are 14 congressmen who have asked the Inspector General of the Commerce Department to look into the ethics issues. The Office of Government Ethics was recently looking into those same issues, and Senator John Thune, who's a Republican from South Dakota, has recently asked the Inspector General also to review some of the conclusions that it drew in a previous report. So there's a lot of scrutiny around Secretary Ross right now.
Dan, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me.
Dan Alexander is a reporter at Forbes. We talked about his recent report that says Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross may have defrauded multiple business associates of millions of dollars. Right now, you may have borrowed books and other materials from your local library, but how about seeds? A seed saver project in Appleton lets gardeners grow unique heirloom fruits and vegetables and invites them to harvest seeds to keep the project going. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you grow heirloom fruits and vegetables from seeds? Do you, when you garden to get seeds at the end of the year and use them for the next year? Would you want to participate in a project like this? Have you done something like this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carrie Witoon-Henning founded the Appleton Seed Library in 2016, located at the Appleton Public Library. She's also an Outagamie County Master Gardener. Carrie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello. Thanks for having us. We're excited to share our knowledge and passion.
Well, tell us how you got this seed library started.
Oh, that's a big question. Careful planning, motivated by our community. So I had been a Outagamie County Master Gardener, and one of our requirements is that we plug into our community, and this was a perfect fit for me. I'm a backyard gardener. Once, you know, seed planting, buying time comes around, that gets expensive. So a great motivator, I think it was an NPR program by Tom Ashcroft on seed libraries that spurred this whole chain of events. So this is coming full circle that we're sharing our space. Yeah, pretty awesome.
Well, talk us through how it worked. If I'm a gardener in the Appleton area and I want to check out some seeds, how does that work and what can I get?
Perfect. So, yes, if you're in the Fox Cities area, the actual seed library is located within the Appleton Public Library, located downtown. It's a self-serve station, so once you go into the library, you peruse the drawers, which are actually in an upcycled old Dewey Decimal System of card catalogs. So the seed packets are now enchanting those drawers. And it's, like I said, it's self-serve. So you borrow, grow, and share. There's a form right there at the seed library station where you fill out some basic information if you want to stay connected in upcoming events, if you want some garden mentorship, things of that nature. And essentially, you borrow it like you would borrow a book. They're not barcoded, so you don't get fines in this case. It's just a way to build community for anybody who might be interested.
And there's something special about at least a lot of these seeds. They're heirloom. They're special varieties. Can you talk about what kind of plants you've focused on so far?
Yes, absolutely. So to get this project up and growing, we had to reach out to some intentional seed savers, you know, throughout the nation. Seed Savers Exchange was an instrumental helper in our process. They donated a good portion of the heirloom seeds that got us up and growing. And for those who aren't familiar, they have a extensive collection of heirloom seeds that they work to preserve that diversity. I lost track.
Oh, that's okay. Actually, I want to bring on a caller now. We'll go to Julie with us in Two Rivers. Julie, hi. You're on the air.
Hi.
What do you want to
Julie.
What do you want to tell us about Julie?
My family, my grandmother came from Hungary in 1919, I think it was. Can't remember the exact year off the top of my head. But she brought Hungarian pepper seeds with her. Ooh. And we grow those every year. And we would certainly be willing to contribute to the seed bank.
And Julie, so each year you plant these, I don't know if this is a paprika that we're talking about here, but you plant these peppers and then you harvest the seeds and you plant the seeds next year, right?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling. So Carrie, somebody like Julie who has a cool plant, how do they contribute their seeds to your project?
Excellent. Yes. Julie is the catalyst of what keeps this community project thriving. Since it's Borrow, Grow, and Share, people like Julie, if she's not in our community, there will probably be an email link attached to this program, or you can always find us very easily on Facebook. If you just punch in Appleton Seed Library, you can be directly linked right to our page, send us messages. We often send self-addressed envelopes to people like Julie to send us seeds where we can capture her story, the longevity, you know, growing notes of the particular plant, how many years she's saved and grown it, all those rich information that we help document, save, and share that with the community. So, Julie, please reach out to us on one of those avenues. We'd love to share your family's Hungarian pepper seeds.
Thanks for the call, Julie. We're talking to Carrie Watoon-Henning with the Appleton Seed Library. And Carrie, suppose somebody wants to do this. They want to check out the seeds, and they want to complete the circle. They want to harvest the seeds, give them back to you so that somebody else can do this. Not everybody, I wouldn't know for a lot of plants, how to harvest the seeds and preserve them properly. Do you help out with that?
Absolutely, yes. That can be a stumbling block for a lot of people to be engaging in the project. And the best advice that I got even when researching this and starting it was pretty simple. You start small. You literally start with one plant each season. Some of the very easy ones to do that you cannot screw up because they're self-pollinating even before the flower opens, they're called selfers, would be beans, peas, lettuce, and oftentimes tomatoes are a really easy entry into the seed-saving world. The beans and peas are especially easy because you can literally let them just go on the plant after you eat some for your harvest. If you just let that plant finish its life cycle, you're on your way to seed saving because those pods will begin to dry out. And then you carefully just, you know, harvest those dried pods and make sure they are completely dry before saving them in an airtight glass container for next year. So it's pretty easy on some plants. And like I said, start with one.
And are there, now some plants, you usually want to harvest them before they go to seed, if you're eating them at home. But I guess what, we'd set aside one or two plants and say, I'm going to let this one go to seed this time around so we can harvest those.
That's a double-edged sword. Some plants, you do actually harvest the seed at what you would consider market maturity. Tomatoes are a perfect example. You can have your BLT, eat it and save at the same time. You would just scoop out the seeds from the caverns of the tomato as you slice it, and then you get to enjoy both. But some definitely are a little bit more advanced. Mm-hmm. Some have to be past market maturity, like cucumbers and squash, things of that nature. So
let's bring on another caller now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. I've got actually a few questions. One, I imagine this is only for the Appleton area. How easy is it to start something like this in a different area? Like, is there one in Madison, Wisconsin? And also, these heirloom varieties, I imagine they will pollinate with, like, something else if it's grown in, like, a community garden. Are, like, heirloom traits dominant, or will they or will they form like a hybrid between something that's there already?
Okay, a couple big questions there, John. Let's start with if somebody wanted to start their own seed library in a community further away from the Fox Cities, Carrie, how would you suggest they get started?
Sure. I haven't visited Madison myself, but I've heard from numerous people that your local library system actually has numerous throughout Madison. So you might want to just jump online and Google like Madison Seed Libraries to see which branch location may be already your people doing this. And you can always plug in, as these are mostly volunteer-run projects. People are always looking for fellow enthusiasts to jump in and join their crusade. But you certainly can start your own, like I did. Lots of research is out, or lots of information is right at your fingertips if you have access to online. You Google how to start a seed library. Endless possibilities right there. Richmond Grows, which is out in California, was a huge catalyst for getting me the confidence and helping with, you know, printed materials, how to properly label these seed packets to comply with seed laws. So you need to find your people. You need to get basic supplies, envelopes, the actual seeds, you know, somewhere to house them. So it's definitely attainable, yes.
Thanks a lot for the call, John. I don't think we have time for that cross-pollination question. But, Carrie, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, fabulous. Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Carrie Watoon-Henning. She founded the Appleton Seed Library in 2016. She's also an Outagamie County Master Gardener. She joined us to talk about how to practice seed saving in our gardens and tell us about the Appleton Seed Project. If you've ever been to an estate sale, a flea market, or an antique store, you know that the kinds of items for sale come in all shapes and sizes, and sometimes they come with a good story. Our next guest has been in the antiques and resale business for decades, and he's got a lot of stories to share about the business, some good, some weird, and everything in between. Dwayne Scott Cerny is the co-owner of the Broadway Antique Market, Chicago's oldest and largest vintage shopping destination. His new book is called Selling Dead People's Things, Inexplicably True Tales, Vintage Fails, and Objects of Objectionable Estates. He's speaking tomorrow afternoon at 3 at Antiques on Pierce in Milwaukee, co-sponsored by the Boswell Book Company. Dwayne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, you got started early, and I'm not talking like early 20s here. You were in the resale trade starting at about 8 years old. Can you tell us how that happened?
Yeah, I would consign the toys of my neighbors and friends and sell them on my parents' front porch.
It was, and you had a sign up that said it was a porch store, which led to some confused
yes.
passersby.
Yes. It would just confuse people. Adults would come by and ask if I did aluminum siding, or you know, could I recommend a good roofer? Yeah. So wrong visual.
Now, what is it about resale and vintage items that captures your imagination today, and started to at such an early age?
I think probably goes back to the fact that loved that my parents' basement was just filled with all the things from their first apartment. And I would rather be down in the basement and playing with 50s lamps and 60s sofas than go outside. And, of course, my mother thought something was wrong with me. but I realized then, too, when I would go to the homes of friends, it would be the same thing. You go into the basement, and that's where kind of all the old stuff was, or in the attic. So I was just really just drawn to it. And, it took a number of years of kind of failing in a number of other businesses before I kind of stumbled back into this and just recognized just how much I loved it.
And these objects, it seems like what you stumbled on was this idea that the stuff we own, or in some cases the stuff we leave behind after we pass on, it tells a story, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, I like to say, you know, we're the temporaries. It's the objects that go on and on. The objects change owners, I think they play a role in so many people's lives. And if you consider, if you just look around your own apartment or home, you know, everything got there via you. You either inherited it or found it or purchased it, And it reflects so much about what you like, and it kind of defines who you are.
I want you to take us behind the scenes in the life of an antique dealer. You deal in a lot of vintage things. Is it kind of like a feast or famine thing? Like sometimes nothing interesting is showing up, or you're not finding good stuff, and then all of a sudden there's this treasure trove.
Absolutely, and almost every dealer will echo that sentiment. There used to be kind of a dry run of finding pretty much, you know, next to nothing. And then it's run, run, run. seems to come in spurts, but you have to be prepared for that. So you've saved up your pennies, so you've got some money to spend, and that the van is empty and gassed up and ready to go. The race is to the swift, if not the swiftiest.
We are talking to Duane Scott Cerny. His new book is Selling Dead People's Things. He's talking about his career in resale and the stories that things tell about us. A common scene for you, Duane, is you're at somebody's house. They've got old things they want to sell. Maybe it's things owned by a relative who's passed on. And people, again and again, they think they want to sell it. They think they don't want to sell it. They're negotiating with themselves in some ways, it seems like.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some people aren't ready to part with things. And we always respect that. I always encourage people to keep family photos and heirlooms. I mean, once it's gone, it's gone. No pressure from us. But then oftentimes, you know, there is a time factor involved. So when someone has to empty out a house or a condo, there's a closing, and time is the most difficult thing to deal with, because the less of it you have, the poorer decisions you make. Let's put it that way.
And you tell, most of your book is actually telling stories about things you've encountered in your career. There's one toward the end that I kind of don't want to spoil. I might dance around it in a bit. But the first story, chapter one, you titled this Traces of a Man Who Disappeared, an estate on the west side, I think it was, of Chicago. Can you talk us through this story, what you discovered about this person whose stuff you were going to sell?
Sure. That's the story that really triggered the book, because it was I'd written a number of things, a number of different topics, and nothing really resonated. I did this piece, and it ended up getting picked up in the New York Times and caused a bit of a sensation because of its it addresses a number of things. Let's put it that way. We often have preconceptions about people. Like you said, any number of the stories are very much O. Henry type,
right?
situations. Put that out there. So yeah, we don't want to ruin it. But what I had assumed was an elderly couple, and they were very much I don't want to call them hoarders. You know, there's low end hoarders. People always think of hoarders as being low end, but you know, there's high end, and that's people who have money to spend on whatever they want, and that can get out of hand. And it was one of those. So the home was massive. It had been a huge barn, which was remodeled into a private residence, and I completely misjudged what I was looking at. Well, just, I think I don't want to go too much farther into that, but it was a bit of an eye opener.
Okay, you don't want to spoil it too much. All right.
It's actually, if anybody wants to read that, like you said, Traces of a Man Who Disappeared, you can Google it. It's on the New York Times website. Give you a little taste of the book.
All right. Well, so for people who are shopping, people who are on the other side of the equation, talk about some of the characters, the people who are antiquers, I guess, or vintage hunters.
People have all types of reasons for what they collect and why they collect it. And we're often dealing with people who have, you know, they don't have a dozen owls. They have 500 owls. so it's and even we dealers often talk about this, is, you know, what one is fine, two is fun, you know, three is suddenly collection, but you get, you know, 20 or 30 of them and it becomes something else. And you can almost switch out that noun of an owl or a monkey or again, pick a niche, any niche. and it kind of can move into an obsession where people spend a lifetime looking for these things. We've got a longtime gentleman who shops the store. He's just wonderful. And he collects 6-inch advertising rulers.
They have to be not a foot.
6-inch advertising rulers. And of course, it has to be one that he doesn't have in the condition that's maybe better than one he's got in his collection. Very specific. He's got a great collection. And again, you can just fill in the blank.
And do you become what, yeah. do you become like his guy? So he says, Dwayne, you get that 6-inch advertising ruler from yep. Sears circa 1911. Call me. Like, yep. you get a lot of people like that?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, we keep lists. We have a wish list, want list for some of the more obscure things. And, you know, all I have to do is say, well, gee, we're never going to get another one of those. And then one walks in the door. Yeah, I've eaten my hat enough times to be that I should be collecting hats.
Right, right, exactly. We're talking with Dwayne Scott Cerny, co-owner of the Broadway Antique Market in Chicago. We're talking about his new book, Selling Dead People's Things, Inexplicably True Tales, Vintage Fails, and Objects of Objectionable Estates. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you always wondered or wanted to know about how this works, vintage and antique sales? Do you have your own story about a great vintage find? Are you an antiquer or a collector of some particular kind of thing where you hit the antique stores, the flea markets, estate sales, looking for that one kind of thing? We'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. We pick up our conversation with Dwayne Scott Cerny, co-owner of the Broadway Antique Market in Chicago. His new book is Selling Dead People's Things. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you like to go to antique stores, flea markets, estate sales? What are you looking for when you're there? Do you have the story of a great find or the one that got away that you can share with us? Or do you have a question about the business? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Jason is on the line in Green Bay. Jason, hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. My question to your guest is, how often does he run into situations where someone's pursuit of the thing is almost more satisfying and enjoyable than actually acquiring the thing? The reason I ask, my father, we're of German heritage, and my father was on a kick, my elderly father, chasing down antique beer steins from the 1800s. There was a company, Metlock, and they were highly desirable. And it gave him so much pleasure searching Craigslist and eBay for these old beer steins, and the guy doesn't even drink. But he just liked collecting them, putting them on a shelf in the basement, and then it was on to the next chase of a beer stein. One day I went over there and noticed there's no more beer steins. I said, Dad, what did you do with all of these? Well, son, you know, I'm getting older, so I gave them to an auctioneer to sell for me. I said, yeah, I thought to myself, you spent a couple of years collecting this, and now you're just going to get rid of them? And he said, well, to him, it's the thrill of the chase.
Interesting.
So I guess I'd like your guest's input on that.
Jason, it's not so much the thing as the hunt for the thing, for some people anyway. Dwayne?
Yeah, actually, it's the endorphin rush of shopping. there's no reason to go and separate this from that vintage or antiques would be different from anything else. It's the hunt, it's finding it, but it's not necessarily buying it. and oftentimes people will put in their head, you know, I've had people come in and say, you know, I'm looking for suits of armor. Well, you know, there's not going to be too many suits of armor in Chicago. It could happen. Yeah. But yeah, my guess is even when they find it, well, no, it's nice, but it's not the one I was really thinking of getting today. though, Jason, it's curious with your father, because obviously it brought him happiness. That just the hunt of it and locating these beer steins in a way fulfilled him as like nothing else in life did, which is kind of special. And I think, again, the book is so much about, you know, people and their things, these objects, that we kind of pay a little more attention to what we collect and why we collect, and what it means to us. And not so much the monetary value. Unfortunately, that kind of gets in the way of things, because there's just a bigger truth in digging deep into why he liked those beer steins and what it meant to him.
Jason, thanks for that call. And that reminds me, I used to do this more. I'd have a mental list of books I'd look for when I was at a used bookstore, you know, not to collect them, not fancy editions, just stuff I wanted to read and own. And, you know, the internet came along and I knew, oh, I could find that in 2 seconds and get it sent to me. But where's the fun in that? So I wanted to ask, how much has online shopping, eBay, things like that changed your business?
I think the business had to adapt, like every business has had to adapt to the internet. Suddenly that instant gratification really isn't as gratifying when it just shows up in the mail. that process of discovering something at a yard sale or an estate sale or an antique shop, that's a totally different experience than sitting in front of your monitor. It's rather bounced back, I've seen. I think since about 2010, something like that, the vintage business has kind of certainly picked up, because I think the novelty of the internet is worn off a bit. Not that you can't get great things there, you know, that's fine, but that hunt, and there's just a certain like satisfaction that you really did something rather than just click a mouse.
Let's go to another caller now at 800-642-1234. Michelle is with us in Wausau. Michelle, hi.
Hi. I was just going to say, I think for me, no matter what it is that I'm kind of collecting, and I don't have that one thing that I really look for, but it's being able to get the history of that item along with the item, or maybe you don't even purchase the item, but it's interesting to hear the history that came with the item that you're looking at.
Michelle, thanks for calling. Dwayne, how often do you have that story behind the items you're buying and selling?
Well, thank you, Michelle, because that really nails down the coffin lid on this book. Is getting that story is finding out who owned it, what were they like, what else interested them. That to me, that backstory is everything. The commerce kind of gets in the way of all of that, unfortunately. So I think it's cool that Michelle gets it, because not everybody does.
Thanks, Michelle, for calling in. We're talking to Dwayne Scott Cerny. His new book is Selling Dead People's Things, Inexplicably True Tales, Vintage Fails, and Objects of Objectionable Estates. Back to your calls. Mark is on the line in Three Lakes. Mark, hello.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you want to tell us about, Mark?
Well, I am a collector of collections, and I'm always looking for something to, how can I put it, I'm 60-plus years old. What will, how can I put it, keep its value, and my, you know, if I pass, what will it be worth to somebody else?
And what are you collecting these days, Mark?
My favorite collection is tools.
Like antique or vintage tools?
Like hand tools of vintage is great because they've standed the test of time.
Uh-huh. Mark, thanks a lot for sharing that. Mark collects collections. He's moving on from one thing to another. Do you meet people like that, I assume, Dwayne?
And as far as tools, Mark won the little lotto on that one. Because that's a solid market, both rural interest and city interest. Vintage tools, he's right. It's just the quality of how things were made. I'd be curious what his other collections are. Vintage tools is a good one. You can't, you know, at least he didn't say Franklin Mint. You know, I was getting a little worried there.
And Dwayne, how often do you see people, you mentioned, you know, sometimes stuff is just stored away in the basement. Tools, I could definitely see, you know, having those on display. They're great decorations, too, in addition to collecting. How much are people flaunting this stuff versus sort of tucking it away?
It's probably 50-50 on that. I mean, you know, in the business, we call these things, if you just collect them, let's say, you know, people collect telephones, vintage telephones, and you know, they use a cell phone. They don't use the telephone. Those are shelf sitters. But it's part of your decor. Again, what I was talking about earlier, you know, that's it. You're surrounding yourself with all these things, and it makes you happy. When things start to get a little out of hand, or you're starting to rent storage units and packing these things away, I think some of the magic disappears there. I think it's 50-50 on that one.
Time for another caller. Mike is with us in La Crosse. Mike, hi.
Hello, how's it going?
Good. What do you collect, Mike?
I collect cookie jars.
All right. Any great stories? Any favorite finds?
I got a real good story. I started collecting them like 25 years ago, and I just decided I like cookie jars. And my oldest boy at the time was probably 5 years old, and I'd always look through the Foxy Shopper and the newspapers and stuff here in town. And I seen an auction about 30 miles, or a rummage sale about 30 miles away that advertised cookie jars. So Saturday morning, we get up early. I take them to McDonald's for the big adventure, you know. And we get to the rummage sale, and it was a littler old lady. And it was in the fall. And I was looking around, dragging him along, you know. And he had a runny nose and everything. The lady asked me finally, she says, are you looking for something special? And I said, yeah, I was looking for the cookie jars you advertise. And she says, well, someone came last night and bought them all.
Oh, no.
She says, but I got one in the house.
Uh-huh.
She says, I wasn't going to sell it, and I'm going to have to ask a little bit more money for it. Would you like to look at it? I said, sure. And so we walk in, and she pulls her hanky out of her coat pocket and wipes my boy's nose and everything else. She had the cookie jar full of receipts sitting on her kitchen counter, and she said, this is it. And I'm looking, and it was a very nice cookie jar. She says, well, like I said, I'll have to ask a little bit more money for it. And she says, is $8 too much? I said, no, I'll take it.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that story. Dwayne, just briefly, you've got an event coming up tomorrow. Are you going to be reading some of your stories from the book?
I am, yeah. First time visit to Milwaukee to do a book reading. We're going to do a couple chapters from the book, and it's going to be fun.
Dwayne, it's been fun. Thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Dwayne Scott Cerny, co-owner of the Broadway Antique Market in Chicago. His new book is Selling Dead People's Things, Inexplicably True Tales, Vintage Fails, and Objects of Objectionable Estates. You can hear Dwayne tomorrow, August 10th at 3 at Antiques on Pierce in Milwaukee, where he'll be reading and signing books. That's co-sponsored by the Boswell Book Company. And if you have a vintage story to tell, I mean, a story about vintage stuff, not an old story, you can do that over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you hunt for at antique stores and estate sales. And maybe, like our last caller, share the story of that one great find and the story behind it. Later this month, you might see chef and TV show host Guy Fieri wandering around Milwaukee. Actually, you might see a lot of him going from one bar to another. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, it's part of the first ever in Milwaukee Fieri Con 2018. It's an effort to organize a pub crawl of a bunch of people doing their best to impersonate Guy Fieri. Now, the real Guy Fieri, he's a restaurant owner, right, chef, and the host of, I'm going to say, 20 shows on the Food Network. It might not be 20, but it seems like he's always on. He's known for his enthusiasm for food, low and high, his love of diners and dives, and his goatee and frosted hair and bowling shirts. The organizer of the Fieri Impersonator Pub Crawl in Milwaukee is drawing the idea from a similar event that's gone on in New York City. It includes a fundraiser for childhood cancer, and the only rule, if you show up and wander from place to place, you have to at least attempt to dress as Fieri. So maybe that dyed hair, maybe a goatee, real or not. And then you just got to get really enthusiastic about any food, I guess, that you encounter along the way. So don't be alarmed if you are seeing multiple Guy Fieris while you're out at a tavern in Milwaukee on August 25th. Stick around. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.